thank you for coming. You didn't have a choice, but they did. There's a new movie out, which they'll see all these movies in April. That's the traditional way to come out of retreat, is to watch videos all day for like a month and catch up. It's called, what was it called? About the astronauts. Gravity. Clooney, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. I'm sorry about that, but they like really brave out there. They get stuck out in outer space and they have all these adventures. And I was there in the audience. It was in Sedona. And you could feel this upswelling of human emotion in the theater. I guess that's what a good movie's supposed to do, right? And we have a famous movie maker here. And I don't know, everyone in the audience, their heart was, you know, elevated for a while. And a good movie is like a good Dharma book, I think. And so it was really wonderful. And then I was thinking, oh, Sandra Bullock don't know nothing. Like, she should try a 3-year retreat at Diamond Mountain. Now that's hard. You know, that takes courage, you know. And to go into, just to have a normal 3-year retreat is hard. And you had a special 3-year retreat. And, you know, I think what's amazing people now is that you stuck to it, you know. And people are like, are they still there? I'm like, yeah, they're still there, you know. I got the bills to prove it. And and it's like, it's so wonderful, you know. So I think, I really think of you guys like astronauts and going on into unknown space. And for us to hear you speak, especially Lama Devora tonight, it was so, I don't know about them, but it made me feel like it was all worth it. To hear a report from another planet, you know, a planet of love and porcupines. And, you know, I was like, no, it's very moving. And I don't know, for me, I felt very strongly that I was so happy that we did this retreat and that such beauty has come out of this retreat. And they all look beautiful like that. So I think, you know, I'm very proud of you guys. And I'm very proud of what you're doing. And many people are extremely proud of you. Many people around the world. I'm very happy. So keep going. You know, you're like on the last lap now. So, but many people are very happy and looking forward to hearing you when you come out. Yeah. And you have a lot to teach. You know, they think they didn't do a good retreat because they're not levitating or something. And, but the progress, we can see it, but you can't see it. But you, when you come out, it will, the depth that you have gone to will affect people. Whether you are a great speaker or it doesn't matter, just the fact that you stayed there for 2 years and went deeper, it will change the world. It will affect the world. So I salute you and to honor. I think we're all honored to be a part of your retreat. Mm-way. And then I'm very much impressed, and I don't know, it means a lot to me that the Israeli contingent came from Israel. And you are a good example for all of us, how hard you work. There's a joke around here, you know, if you want something done, give it to an Israeli. And last night we had a team, but the way you work so hard and the way you study so hard and how well you organize and the harmony of your group and the devotion of your group, they have had people here helping since the beginning of the retreat. There's never been a day that there wasn't an Israeli contingent here helping. And I don't think we could have done it without you guys. So thank you for that. Yeah. And also, we over on this side, we have a lot of sponsors. And what I realized was, for someone to keep up, it's one thing to keep in a retreat for 3 years, but it's kind of hard to be working for 3 years and see a deduction from your credit card every month. 3 years later, you're like, why did I do that? You know, and I don't remember what I was thinking, you know, and the perseverance of the sponsors, and through some very difficult times, it was very impressive. And I think they've raised, they've donated almost $1 million, close, not too far off $1 million. And small people, there's been no big sponsors, just all small people, helping. And many of them are here tonight. And, I'd like to salute you also, cause, yeah. And there are many countries represented over here, and it's very sweet. And it's good to see, especially from Mexico. We just got back from there, and some awesome times there. Two of the Mexican students made a film, feature film, about karma and seeds. Very beautiful film, and it was premiered to 1,000 people at the Municipal Theater of Mexico City last month. And it was unbelievable. It's beautiful. So it's good to see so many countries here. And my mom is here, and I want to thank her. And especially the board of directors, they took a lot of heat, very heavy heat, and they are legally responsible for anything that happens here. Financially responsible, personally responsible, because it's a corporation, nonprofit. So they have persevered, and they have done it with good humor and wisdom and kindness and beauty. You know, just wonderful people, and it's an honor. I kind of sorry that to think the retreat is winding down, because then I have to, you know, it's been such a pleasure to be with them. And it's very sweet when we're together. It's very sweet. And I'd like to thank especially Rob Risinger and the rest of the board of directors. Yeah. Board of directors, they want an encore. And all the volunteers, they work really, really hard. And I'd like to give them a hand too. Yeah. Tonight, we're also honored to have Dr. Svieli here, and whose mom just gave such a beautiful talk. And he's been he's an MD, and he's been serving the retreat, and we'd like to honor him also here. I'd also like to thank Jeff Eddy and Nick Lasha, who are, we just got back from the prison project. We had a program yesterday, was it? In the prison. They're in four prisons now. Christine Walsh is now in a federal prison. Not in, but I mean. they're all doing awesome work. And the guards and the wardens are always fawning over us because our programs are so great. And the prisoners that we visited yesterday, they are now self-supporting. They have their own teachers who teach the new inmates, and they gave a refuge vow ceremony yesterday. and Lifetime Layman's Vows, and it was all directed by the prisoners. And that's a lot of hard work by Jeff Hedy and a lot of Nick Lashley. Okay, let's start. So we're having I think it's a 12 or 14 year trip to the Lam Rim, started 3 years ago. It's a text, Lam Rim means A to Z, Buddhism for idiot, what do you call dummy's guide to Buddhism, A to Z. And it's a genre of literature that was popular, started in India, but it really reached its pinnacle in Tibet. And it's a specific series of meditations that if you devote a couple of years to going through those meditations, then it's believed that you could become enlightened. And it's called Lam Rim. Lam means marga, path, and rim is, I don't know, steps of the path. And so we've been going through that. I was taught very kindly that by my teacher. I think it's the greatest book ever written on this planet. It was written by the teacher of the teacher of the current Dalai Lama, who was also my teacher, teacher's teacher. And in that book, he devotes a large quantity of his teaching to how to prepare properly for meditation. It's called Jorcha. Jor means, in this case, preparing for meditation. Cha means practice. So there are... in that book, he gives the best presentation of Jorcha that I'm aware of. And in that presentation, which we just finished after 3 years, he often refers to his teacher's song, meditation song. His teacher was Jampel Hundup Gyatso, Dakpo Rinpoche, Jampel Hundup Gyatso. And his teacher wrote a meditation song on how to prepare for a meditation. So the Jorcha, the six... did they get a copy of these? Did they get a copy? They didn't. They're shaking their heads. So his teacher wrote a beautiful ritual for how to go into a deep meditation, the Jorcha. So, and he often quotes it. And then I thought we should pause in the Lam Rim teaching and review the Jorchas that we've done for the last two years or so that we've been on that subject. And then it would be a nice time to actually read the original by his teacher and translate it and give it to you so you could use it. It's meant to be sung or chanted before a meditation session. And it's very, very exquisite. It's very beautiful. And so there's been a team of people working on this translation and publishing the book. It was laid out in Guadalajara by our Guadalajara team. And the photos came from all over the world. And somebody drove 8 hours today to get it from the printer. And it just got here like a half hour ago. And so I'd like to thank everyone who worked on that. Yeah. Especially Venerable Jigme worked really hard on it, and I'd like to thank you for that. Yeah. She has to pay for all my parties. Okay. So we're going to pause in the Lam Rim teaching. We're going to spend 10 days on this ceremony, which is normally sung before you do a deep meditation. The components in this ritual are meant to prepare your mind for meditation, and it is believed that if you do this ritual before meditation, the meditation will be much more powerful and much deeper, because its function is to purify negative karma and to accumulate positive karma just before you go into meditation. Very powerful practices, series of thoughts through which you take your mind. And then you go to a meditation on the Lam Rim. Then you meditate on the Lam Rim. So what he did in his text, at the end of the text, he put a Lam Rim, which is the source of all my good, Yunden Shigyuma. So that's the last part of the text. And it's meant to that you go through the preliminaries and then you choose a subject from the last part, the last few pages, and you meditate on that, on the Lam Rim. Like it could be impermanence, death. It could be compassion. It could be the four immeasurables, like from the Yoga Sutra. And you choose one of the subjects from the end, and then you meditate on that. So you go through the whole ceremony, and then you choose a subject from the end. We've purposely put about 10 blank pages at the end. And what I was hoping was that each person could take notes. Because I didn't want to put my comments in the book. I thought you should just have the original by itself. But a lot of it, it needs comments. And if you're going to teach it to your disciples, your students, which is a very sweet thing to teach. Ken Rinpoche, when he first taught us 39 years ago, he said we couldn't learn Tantra unless we memorized this. And we had to memorize it. So when I was like 20, I had to memorize this text. And it means a lot to me. And it's very beautiful. So I think it's a wonderful thing to get in your toolbox, a wonderful thing to have to teach you, especially new students. They can learn to prepare properly for a meditation. So I encourage you, especially those of you who are teaching, which is most of you, which is the real glory of this university. It really is a university, and there are 303 people in the world teaching ACI courses. So take notes, okay? Use the pages in the back. Somebody told me, Geshe-la, they're bound in the book. Duh! I want you to have your notes with you, so you can't separate them from the book. When you teach it, you can just flip back and see, you know, what you were supposed to be thinking at that moment. So I purposely put. So I really will be very happy if I see people taking notes in the back of their book for the next 10 days, okay? Because then you can teach it to other people well, okay? So let's go. Also, this was originally meant, you know, it's a meditation song, like a Gita, meant to be sung. And we had this wonderful idea that over the next 10 days, these guys will be dividing into groups. And so we'll just have one session in the evening and that's it. No other sessions. Usually we do other philosophy books and stuff. There'll be no other sessions, just one session at night. And then during the day we will work together to create a performance piece of this song. So on this side we're going to do poetry, dance, songs, rock and roll, cowboy music, jazz, James Brown music. There's different groups, like you're either in the James Brown group or you're in the jazz group or you're in the poetry, or some people just lead a meditation in their own way. And then somebody's doing trapeze, you can't guess who that would be besides me. And so my dream is that, and I had long talks with my own teacher about it. My dream is that without thinking that you're performing, there will be no audience for the final performance, which will be next Sunday, a week from Sunday in Scottsdale. We have a nice place there ready, and we will do the performance, but there won't be any audience except Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the universe. And I just thought it would be nice for a group of people to say, okay, we're going to put together a sweet, moving performance for invisible beings, you know, that we can't see. And there's going to be, try to not have ego. You know what I mean? Like, there's nobody to perform for except them, you know, and there's no reason to sing your song well or do your dance well except to please them and to make an offering to them. So I just had this really strong desire that we do a piece together. Everybody do something. Even if you're shy, you can say, okay, I'm leading a meditation. I told the DCI teachers, if you get stuck on the stage, lead a meditation. Because then you don't have to say anything for 10 minutes. And so if you're shy or doesn't matter, you know. Let's just do something. I told them I would do a ballet piece that's been in my head for years, you know. But I told them I wouldn't wear the tights, okay? I think we just let go and have fun and make an offering to a bunch of invisible beings, you know, and make it from your heart and no one's watching. Sometimes I dance in my house just by myself and offer it, you know, and then nobody cares if I slip or, you know. So like that. So just I'd like to propose that we do that, okay? Then you're going to have lots of time during the week to practice. And you'll be in your own group. Maybe you'll be in one or two groups and you get together with five or six other people and you do it. And I would propose that you guys do it too. I don't know when your non-layering ends. How many more days? Show me with your fingers. Yeah, so if you want to, do it on Sunday at the same time. And we'll just make it at different times so they can get to yours. But I think it'd be nice, anybody who wants to sing a song or you do a dance or read a poem. It could be something you wrote yourself. It could be something you like from earlier in your life, you know, or you just make a new meditation and you lead it, or a new yoga series, some yoga movements or something like that. Anything, you think about it, but make it beautiful. And what I'm really asking people to do is devote some real time to it. Like, it's not a, what do you call those things when people get up and just, it's not karaoke or, what's a talent show or, what do you call that? They can't talk. It's not like just people get up and do something improvised. Yeah, no, I'd like to, see, but we can do comedy also, Grant. Wait, no. But I'd like to see it I don't know, just something that comes from your heart and you do it, you know, and you don't worry. But I also don't want it to be amateur. Like, you should practice it over and over. When we play jazz someplace, we have a rule. We play the song 5 times every day for like, it's a lot of time. So I mean, make it serious, like the Dalai Lama's coming, you know, and, you're not just going to get up and bang on a drum or, you know, without practicing. So I'm really hoping, I'm asking people this week to devote maybe 4, 5, 6 hours a day to getting ready for Sunday, your piece. And then on this side, we have a few people who are going to, what do you call, direct it. We've been importing a director from one of Lama Maru's Hollywood groups. And they're going to kind of make sure that, what do you call it, the transitions are done nicely. Like, I don't want to somebody sing a song and then everybody waits, and then it should really be done, what do you call it, polished as well as we can being amateurs. But it should be serious, you know, like this is a real thing that we're doing for Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and it shouldn't be a talent show thing or, what do you call that when people get up and sing it at night? Like Mike Niner said, it should be a polished thing. You should put your heart into it. You should spend 20 hours on it or something, 30 hours on it. Don't make it something that you were too busy to make a proper offering. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm saying give a whole week to making a... My ballet piece is 1.30 minutes. It's 1.5 minutes. But I'm going to make it nice, you know. And I have a piano player. And I hope. And I just make it exquisite. That's what I'm saying. Give it a week. Give it a whole week. Or give it a lot of your week. And don't just say, oh, on Saturday night, you're like, oh, I'll write down the words to this song that I kind of like. And then don't do it like that. Like, do it really give it a week of your time. Give it the best that you have, you know. Don't say you don't have time. Give it your time. That's what I'm saying. It's hard to get money out of Americans, but getting time out of them is impossible. You know, so give it your time. Really give it some time. Serious time. Okay? Make it your practice for a week. That's what I propose, if you guys want to do it. You can ask Brady. He's in charge. Okay. So let's go through the text. I'll stop around, what time is it supposed to be? 9:30, I think. Yeah? Okay. And bear with me. I know you're tired, especially I know what it's like when you come out for... I used to get this migraine, and it wouldn't go away until I went back in the lay room. And then we tried not coming out, and that was worse. So I know it's exhausting for you. I know it's a lot. That's a lot. But hang in there. Just everybody hang in there, okay? It's worth it. It's something... The reason we bound it with spiral binding is you can lay it flat, like David Swenson's Ashtanga manual that sold 5 million copies. No, it's just like you can lay it on the floor and it'll stay there. And then you can meditate. You don't have to do the whole thing, by the way. I clock it at 45 minutes, which is too much for this side of the room. Forget it. You can just do some part of it, you know, before your meditation, do some part of it. The supplication part at the end, which is our whole parampara, it's our whole lineage thing. It's long. And you might want to just skip that and go into your meditations, okay? So you don't have to do the whole thing every day, but it's nice if you learn how to do it. Okay. So let's start. The name of the text is Kelsang Dingen. You can talk Tibetan, right? Kelsang Dingen. Kelsang Dingen. Sometimes they call it Jorche Kelsang Dingen. Jorche, as I said, means preliminary practice to a meditation. There are six classical Jorches. There are six preparations to a meditation. The fifth one has seven parts. So total is, be careful. I count 12, right? See what I mean? 7 plus 5, because the fifth one is all in the seven. So basically there are 12 important practices that you should do before you do a meditation. Okay, in our tradition, and this is heavy duty, Jetsun Kapa, Dalai Lama, Ken Rinpoche, direct tradition. This is our lineage. This is your lineage. Like it or not, this is your lineage. Okay, if you are here at Diamond Mountain, if you're studying ACI, DCI, all those other CIs, this is your shtick. This is what we do, okay? And it's not what other people do in this country. And that's uncomfortable for some people, but that's life. You know, this is an ancient and very strictly held tradition. And I love it. And I think it, for me, it works. I understand it might be different for different people, I'm sure. But if you want to know what we teach or what we do, it's here. This is what we do. This is who we are, you know. And this is what we do before meditation. This is what we believe in. This is, you know, if you're in this lineage. It doesn't mean you can't do other things, but if you want to know what we do, it's here. This is what we do. This is what we commit our lives to, okay? And happily, proudly. And it's not what everybody else may do. So that's all. Okay. Kel means Kelwa, means good karma from the past. And it's like a quantity thing, like how much Kelwa do you have? And you might have enough Kelwa to hear about Diamond Mountain. You might have enough Kelwa to come here. It would take more Kelwa. To do a retreat here would take extraordinary Kelwa. You are one in, the people sitting over here are one in 10 million in this country. One out of 10 million people in this country is sitting over here, had enough Kelwa to do a three-year retreat. And it's a very expensive Kelwa, karmically very expensive. You'll probably be filling propane tanks for thousands of lifetimes. And Chuck will have them filling his propane tanks for thousands of lifetimes. So Kelwa means how much good karma do you have, you know? Like, Do you have enough kawa to get here? Do you have enough kawa to hear it? Do you have enough kawa to understand what's being said and not fall asleep? You know, there's all different levels of kawa. So that's kawa. Kel sang means sangbo, means you got a good one. You got good kawa. Okay, you have enough karma from your previous lives, billions of lives, countless lives. You've done enough kindnesses to other people that you get to meditate on the path to enlightenment. And that's expensive karma, very, very rare. It takes millions of lifetimes to get here. And to do a meditation takes millions of lifetimes. To have the honor or the ability or the interest to do meditation, it takes many, many lifetimes. So you are kelsang, okay? You are kelsang. Din means throat. It's honorific for throat, din. And gen means a necklace, ornament, alankara. So kelsang, the name of the book is a necklace for those who have enough good karma to hear it. A necklace for those who have enough good karma to hear it. And necklace is meant to mean you're supposed to sing it. So you're supposed to put this text on your voice box and sing. That's the meaning of Dingen, okay? Kelsang. So that's the name of that's the sub name of the text, okay? Meditation song. Kelsang Dingen. The author's name is on the cover. Dakpo Lama Rinpoche Jampel Thundup Gyatso. And he was the teacher of Pabongkor Rinpoche. Okay. And we found a drawing of him. It was tiny. And we blew it up. So it's kind of rough, but let me see what page it's on. It's on page 122. Okay. And there were no cameras in those days. And I believe that's the only image of him. There's two of them. And we got it off of this poster, actually. This is the Lama lineage poster. And he's in two places. He's on the Bodhisattva side and he's on the wisdom side. And he's not named, but he's sitting next to his teacher, you know, so we know who he is. And that's the only image of him that I'm aware of. It's kind of cool. So I think we'll just go through it and do it together. There's some notes on page 3 about how to pronounce things, don't worry about it. Page 3 also says, take your time. Okay? So for an American, I think that's the biggest advice you can give someone who's going to do this practice is make it sweet. Give up a day and do it. You know, like when I cook for my Lama, I spend 2 days and that's it. 3 days, because the third day I clean the dishes. And I take my time. And it's a struggle for me not to rush or to forget the other things I have to do, you know, to really devote myself to that offering. So it requires your attention and your time. Or don't do it. Do something else, okay? It's like that. Okay, the first page you can see, this is a beautiful photo. I think it was taken by Michael Wick in about 1972. And it's Ken Rinpoche himself doing the Jorcha. Okay, so I thought we don't have many photos of him, but we have this photo of him doing the Jorcha. If you're interested, it was on 3rd Street in Howell, New Jersey. And he was in Geshe Wangyal's monastery and when he first came. So he's probably about 50 years old, 51, and in that photo. And he's doing the Jorcha. Okay, I really like the photo. There's a reason why I put it there. Every photo has a reason, and I want to talk about them. This particular photo, the Jorcha is founded on Guru Yoga. Okay? The Jorcha is founded on Guru Yoga. The preparing for meditation and all practices in our tradition are founded upon your relationship to a living teacher, you know. And the word guru in this country is poisoned, right? It's been poisoned, which is very strange because it's like the most important word in Sanskrit. And it's a sad, terrible demon thing, you know, that people told me, oh, it's all guru stuff. And we believe in our tradition, Guru in Tibetan is Lama, right? Translated into Tibetan is Lama. So in our tradition, the reason Ken Rinpoche's picture is first, in our tradition, a living human being who takes you into their care is the basis of all evolution of a person. All spiritual life is, all your spiritual life is based on a relationship with a human living, if you can, teacher, and not a book or internet. Or I heard some of my students are getting stuff off the internet to fill in tantric practices, and I think it's not good. You get those things from a human being, and that's our lineage. That's just who we are. That's just what our lineage is. You carefully, and the tradition is sometimes to wait for 12 years before you accept the person as your teacher. Be with them for 12 years before you call them your lama. But you have to find one. And they're all different. Everyone's different. We all have different temperaments. We all have different personalities. Some people are nerds. Some people are into dance. Some people like farming. You know, everyone will have their own lama. But you cannot be lama-less. Okay? And in this tradition, you cannot reject the idea of a lama, period. You have to find one who fits you. And it could be unexpectedly. It could be, I know some people whose martial art teacher are their lama, and that's okay. You know, or their yoga asana teacher is their lama. That's okay. But you must find one. And you cannot, in this tradition, you cannot engage in a practice like this necklace without having that relationship, or at least being in the process of seeking that relationship. Even in monasticism, we have what we call Nelama, right? And we have rites, 108 rites, monastic rites and responsibilities. And they are very serious, like going to Sojong, attending every 2 weeks the confession ceremony is required of all monks. But if you lose your teacher, you are exempted from all other monastic rites. You must find a new one. You must stop everything and go find a new one. Or you can't do anything. It's not possible, okay? You just can't do it. You have to find a living teacher who you can be with and learn these things from. So that's why we put that photo there. And you should remember. You should tell your students, okay? Teachers can make mistakes. Teachers can have problems. But you can't live without them, okay? And you have to be wise and careful, prudent in finding a teacher, and then you must serve them, okay? The happiest years of my life, my whole life, I've never not had a teacher, you know? And it's the best thing in life. There's nothing better than that, okay? All right. I lived with my lama for 25 years, and it was hard, but it was the best thing in my life. Okay, and I think Lady Ruth would say the same thing with her sweet teacher. So there's an introduction by the author on page 5. I like the second verse. I put verse numbers so we could be on the same page. Okay, I like it. There's a holy being who is half my lama and half the Buddha himself in his most secret form, the keeper of the diamond. The keeper of the diamond is Vajradhara, which is the form that Lord Buddha takes when he teaches the secret teachings, right? These two parts can never be divided from each other. I bow down to the holy feet of this being in every single moment of the day for all days to come. In you do I take my shelter. And I ask you, please, shower upon me your infinite love. Take me with you. Keep me with you. Okay. We'll go to the next page. The notes by the author are in italics, and you're not supposed to sing them, okay? Unless they're mantras. The mantras are also in italics, but the So when you sing it, you don't have to do the his comments, okay? In this holy book, I have set forth in one place just a song that you can sing for the six preparations which you must follow before meditating upon the steps of the path to enlightenment. According to the personal advices of that victorious Buddha, Master Wensapa, the saint of the desert places, and I thought to tell you a little bit about Wensapa, okay? Wensa means a desert place. And so he spent so much time doing retreats in desert plains of Tibet that his name was, they named him Mr. Desert Place, okay, which is what Wensapa means. Gyalwa, his traditional name is Gyalwa Wensapa. Gyalwa means Jina in Sanskrit, it means a Buddha, okay, so Gyal, the victorious one, okay. It sounds like Gyalpo, but it's not. Gyalpo means what, king? Gyalwa means victorious one, okay? So he's often called Gyalwa Wensapa. So what he's saying is that this song has been written in the tradition, in the oral tradition of Gyalwa Wensapa. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about Gyalwa Wensapa, and as usual, it got out of hand. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about his life. Why? If you ask a Tibetan Lama, you know, I think all these practices are nice. They all sound very good. This whole thing is supposed to get you enlightened. Are there any real examples in Tibet? Did somebody see somebody turn into a Buddha after singing this thing? Or so, you know, like, can you point to anybody? You know, because you got, they got 200,000 scriptures in Tibet. 200,000 holy books, you know. But can you show me a person who got enlightened? You know, can you like, can we go see him, you know? And they'll say, Gyalwa Wensapa did. And, you know, of course, many lamas got enlightened, but he's the classical example. So I thought, I was curious, you know, I said, okay, if this guy got enlightened, you know, what happened? He was having breakfast and he bit into that waffle and suddenly turned into light and like, exactly when did it happen and where did it happen? What was going on? You know, like, what did he do? And did anybody write down what happened in that moment? And, you know, how did they know he was a Buddha afterwards? And, you know, so I've been researching this thing because I'm just curious about it. I was just, people ask me also, and I'm kind of like, oh, I don't really know. You know, so here's a little bit, and I'll tell you more tomorrow and I'll tell you more the next day because it's too much to tell in one night. But I'm going to start to tell you his life story, okay? Because I thought it was cool. Just in case we die tonight, he got enlightened, they say, by doing two practices, all right? Two practices. The first was Guru Yoga, his devotion to his teacher, okay? His relationship with the teacher. And secondly, Vajrayogini practice, okay? The practice of Vajrayogini, okay? Which is what this university teaches. It's what the 7-year course is devoted to. And it's what the 3-year retreat is devoted to. So that's how he got enlightened, by those two practices. Okay. Mm. 1505 to 1566 in the mortal body. It's a nice lineage if you are into lineages. Lineages are cool because it's kind of like, okay, Neil Young sang with Buffalo Springfield, and then he broke off on his own and did Neil Young, 2 albums with Crazy Horse. And then after that, you know, he met up with Stephen Stills again and Crosby and Nash, and they did Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. You know, and then they broke up, and, you know, Crosby got arrested, and then they had to do, you know, it's like that. If you really love music, it's nice to know what they went through, the lineage of where they went. Really, it is nice. You can see patterns. So anyway, he was a teacher of Sangye Yeshe, and his best student was, who, do you know? Sangye Yeshe. First Panchen Lama. Okay, who wrote the Devil Angel text that we've been studying, wrote a lot of the text that we, he wrote the Dalam that you study, right? So very important for our lineage, okay? That's the immediate lineage. Okay, he's the teacher of the teacher of the first Panchen Lama. The first Panchen Lama is who he is because of his teacher, and he is who he is because of his teacher's teacher. Okay. Also, when Sapa studied with Genden Gyatso, who's that?
Huh?
Second Dalai Lama. Okay, he was a student of Genden Gyatso, who was a great follower of the Niguma Yoga practice. And Wensapa was also devoted to the Niguma practice. Okay. And he got enlightened, you see.
Okay.
Wensa is also the name of a particular place in Tibet where people did so many retreats that they started to call the place the desert retreat, you know. So the monastery, even before he was born, was called Wensa. Okay. Okay, here's a cool story. Here's the first story, and then maybe we let it go. So I've been trying to find out, you know, where was he at the moment of enlightenment? And what, you know, I'm just curious. So I was reading all his biographies, which is a big trouble. It's a lot of pages of stuff. And there's a beautiful story when he was born. Right out of the womb, like in the first few days, he started to recite, he started to say, Ma Sem Chen Tam Che, Ma Sem Chen Ning Re Je Om Mani Bemi Hu. Ma Sem Chen Ning Re Je Om Mani Bemi Hu. Ma Sem Chen means all living beings who have been my mother in my past lifetimes. We did this meditation, I don't know where it was, recently. Some people objected to it. I was like, pick your enemy and think about drinking milk from their breast. And the people got really uncomfortable, you know? Especially if the enemy was a guy. And but for myself, I found it very, it broke my dislike for this person. You know, like suddenly I had to think of them as my mom. And it was very powerful. So anyway, the first words that came out of his mouth were, every being has been my mother. Ning Rei Jie means, oh man, they're hurting so bad. Ning Rei Jie means compassion, right? Ning Rei Jie in Tibet, it's kind of like, you see a car accident and you go, oh man. You know, it's just, there's no translation, I think. Maybe there's something in Spanish, I don't know. It's like, Ning Rei Jie means, they also say, atsata, atsata. You know, it just means, oh man. You know, like Ning Rei Jie. So he came out saying, oh man. And then, they're all my mom. And then he said, oh my baby, who? You know. So the story is that his father was, he found that disconcerting that an infant would be reciting Om Mani Padme Hum. He was scared by it. He thought that the child was possessed or something. So he actually smothered. He took a Tibetan carpet, a piece of Tibetan carpet, and put it over his face so he wouldn't have to hear it. And it deformed his face as a child. It deformed the bones of his face. And then he had a deformity during his life. So I think it's interesting that this person is going to be the person in Tibet who got enlightened. You know, his face was deformed from childhood because of that incident. And I've read other authors who defend him, you know, they say, no, his face was like amrita for the eyes. You know, they denied that he was unattractive. But so he grew up like that. He grew up that way. I read a text today. When he was 8 years old, he was laying in bed, and the window was open, and the full moon came up, and it broke over the mountains, which is so lovely here. It does that so well here. And then the light hit his chest and his body, and he looked down, and he saw himself dressed in white silk with jewels all over. And then he saw his body floated out of the window, and he was riding on the moon like a horse. And he was, then suddenly there was a bell in his hand and a dorje at 8. And he was ringing the bell. And then the bell sound covered the whole planet, you know. And then his teacher said, oh, that's a good dream, you know. You're going to be teaching the wisdom of Jotsongkhapa, Tantra and Sutra, across this planet. It's a sign that you will teach that across this planet. And then they said he took to Jotsongkhapa's teachings with the instinct of a child sucking milk from the teat of the mother. You see? Like, he didn't, nobody had to ask him. He saw those teachings and he went crazy. And then, there was a disciple of Jotsongkhapa called Dulwa Zimba. And it's believed that he was a past life. In his past life, he was Dulwa Zimba. Dulwa Zimba means the Vinaya holder. And, I think it's Drapa Gyalpa. I'll tell you tomorrow. Drapa something. And then they go into his past lives, and they said he was a yogi in India, in North East India, Bengal, which is like the hotbed. In around 800, 900, it was the hotbed of yoga and tantra. Buddhist and Hindu sages practiced together the teachings of tantra and yoga. And he was born there, and he learned and he spread the tantric teachings there. He also went to China, and in his past life, he's practiced in China at a place called Ryotsenga, which is Wushan, and it means the five mountains. And these are five mountains that are sacred to Buddhists in Tibet and China and India. And Jotsongkhapa is said to have practiced on those mountains also. I went to one of them. And they are in the four directions and the central mountain. And there are five great mountains in China. So he was influenced. His past life influences were Chinese Buddhism, Indian Tantra and Yoga, and Tibet. Okay, so I think he's a special sort of person for us. He studied a lot the six yogas of Naropa and the six yogas of Nyingma. He was also trained in that at, I think, at the age of 11. Okay, so he was special. So that's enough tonight, I think, on Gyalpa Wensapa. Okay, just know the name. A Wensa means a place just like this. Diamond Mountain is one of the few Wensas around. There are definition. It has to be 500 gyangtaks from the nearest town. So I don't know if you're going to count Bui as a town. Now it should. Nowadays they would say it should be out of cell phone range, which it is for my cell phone. And you know, it should be really an. I heard somebody saying, this is out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, yeah, that's a Wensa. That's what it's supposed to be. It's a Wensa. So it's a perfect Wensa. It's a great Wensa. That valley is a very perfect retreat valley. Yeah, hard to find something like that. Okay. So I thought I'd just review with all of you the six preliminary practices. Just the names, and then we'll go through them. Okay. First one is called Nekang Chido Chela Kusun Tukiten Dhamba. And by the way, this is the first step of the Lam Rims, is to prepare for Lam Rim meditations. So this is after you tell people the history of the Lam Rim and all the lamas of the Lam Rim, then you're supposed to start with the Dzogchen. That's supposed to be, even before you talk about lamas, the practice of having a lama, you're supposed to talk about these six preparations, because you can't meditate on the Lam Rim without knowing them. Okay. You can, without this book, you can't meditate on the Lam Rim. Okay. First one, Nekang Chido Che means straighten up your room. Okay, that's the first meditation preliminary. The room should be pleasant, elegant, neat. You know, I don't know. My house was messy when I was growing up. We had four boys, one mom who was working. So, you know, it was not technically neat, but it was warm and loving and full of light. So I don't, when I say the room should be beautiful, I don't mean like my next door neighbor when I grew up, she was this grumpy old lady. and they had a white carpet and a white couch, and they were covered with plastic. And it was so neat and unhappy, you know. So don't get overwhelmed with the neat part. I mean, it means you should, it's our tradition to clean the room and to straighten the room before you meditate. And we'll talk about it. Okay. Chiro chela kusun tuki ten dhamma. Set up your altar. That's still part of number one. Make sure you have an altar. People make fun of American Buddhists, you know. Oh, they're cultish and they have these cardboard boxes with a candle and a flower and a Buddha, a cheap Buddha image from Thailand. No, they make fun. What's her, Alanis Morissette has a song about it. And then when they get cancer, they're all knocking on your door. You know, and like, could you teach me that cardboard box thing? You know, I swear to God, everyone who ever said that to me is, later they write you, even my old Princeton friends, you know, who were lawyers and diplomats, and they're all like, I got lymphatic cancer, got 6 months to live. Tell me what you've been studying. Now I want to know. It's not culty anymore. You know, it's life or death. Now I understand why you were doing it, you know. So you kind of just understand that, you know, regardless of what people say, at the end they realize it's, when it comes to your life, then they realize that nothing else counts. And then they want to know about what you're doing, okay? And then you're going to say, go get a cardboard box. You know, clean up your room and get a cardboard box. I got an extra cheap Buddha from Thailand. You know, and then they're like, oh, thank you, you know. I swear, all my old friends, one by one they came. They're all there. They're all practicing. The ones who made fun of it or said it was culty or things like that. Because it really is the only important thing in life. Other things are important. Other things are wonderful, beautiful. But if they don't have a spiritual component, then they don't matter. They don't have meaning, okay? Everyone understands that by the end of their life, okay? Some people earlier. All right. Second Jorcha. Chipa yome chinkupa zepa shamba. Put forth some kind of offering, which is yome and zep kupa zepa. Yome is not yome. Yome means honestly obtained offerings. The offerings should be totally clean karmically. They should have been obtained either flowers that you found out in the wild, you know, or things that you bought with money that you earned by hard work, you know. It shouldn't be things that you kind of sneakily, what do you call it? Sneakily gotten stuff cannot be used for offerings. Stuff that you grubbed off other people who didn't want to give it to you, really, is not to be offered, okay? It has to be clean, karmically clean, okay? Your livelihood, it has to be honest and sincere, and then you can buy things and offer them, okay? Kupa zepa means they should be beautiful. The arrangement of them on the altar should be attractive, okay? It's not unimportant that things are elegant and when they're spiritual. That's what I was talking about. Your performance, whatever you choose to do, should be beautiful, okay? You should put a lot of work into making it something beautiful. That means something, okay? All right. Sumba. Then they will alone nam nangi chudun then do could they get some kyapachengi ngang ni kyapsan sokchawa. Get a proper meditation cushion. Sit on it in the proper way, the 7-point posture. And then prepare your mind, prepare your heart for meditation, mainly through taking refuge and thinking about bodhicitta, okay? Universal love. You could get a recording of Lama Dvora at that point. That'd be cool. All right. This could take all day. I don't know if I can do this. All right. Don't think like that. Number four is you visualize your lamas and the lamas of the lineage. This is the technical visualization up here. I don't do it because it's too complicated. And you simplify it. There's a Kundu Norbu Luke. where you just see your own teacher. You just imagine your own teacher. So you can go anywhere from one teacher to these. This thing here. Wensop is up there somewhere.
Okay.
Number five. Sak Jang Ne Dupa Yen La Duma Mandal Dan Chepa. That's the seven-part prayer. It's a seven-part prayer that we do. It's a instant good karma collection, instant bad karma purification. Okay, step number five. And then step number six, ask for help just before you meditate. Okay, ask for help. If you study this text, you'll see that probably the last quarter or third is asking for help from all the lamas of the lineage. It's a little too much if you've got a job and you got to get up and go to work, you know? Like, when you get to that part, you can do your own lama and you can start meditating, okay? But you do have to ask someone for help. That's number six, okay? Just before you meditate, ask your teachers for help. Ask somebody for help, okay? All right, those are the six. We're going to go, tonight we'll only cover the first one, okay? This is a review for the people who have been coming to Phoenix and doing the 10-day courses. So I wanted to pause, review the six preliminary practices, and then give you the transmission of this wonderful practice, this oral transmission, okay? So here we go. The first of the preparations is to clean. This is page seven. The first of the preparations is to clean and straighten up your room and set up an altar there. And I'll just, what I did was I went to the Gift of Liberation, Thrust into Your Hands, Nambar Lakchang, which is the real title. I took out the main points to teach in one night. Okay, so we'll just do the main points of how to clean up your room, or the main tradition for teaching this subject. Okay, just this is what he called highlights. What do you call it in football? Highlights? Yeah, replay. They replay the highlights of like 12 games in 5 minutes, right? Okay, so I'll just give you some highlights from the text. First of all, Pabongkwa Rinpoche says that this comes mainly from Lama Serlingpa, which is Suvarna Dvipa, which is whose teacher? Lord Atisha's teacher. Okay, so the Lama who brought this tradition to Tibet from India, his teacher lived in Indonesia, Sumatra. And in the year 950-something, he took a very dangerous sea trip around Southeast Asia to go get this teaching from Serlingpa. And it's said that he after taking, I think it was a 9-month voyage, very, very dangerous, pirates all the way. And, you know, it's a tiny wooden ship in a typhoon area. But he went to get the bodhicitta, the kindness teachings from this famous lama. And it's said that, by the way, when he got there, he didn't go to the lama. He checked him out. And he spent a long time checking him out. He risked his life to go there. He got there, and then he didn't meet the lama. He went and talked to all these people. He did, what do you call it? Detective. What do you call it? He's doing a scoop on him. Like, find out, is there anything bad about him? Has he ever done anything wrong? And it's tradition that he spent a long time checking out the teacher before he went to him, even after the voyage. Then this lama is credited with teaching him about how to clean up your room. Okay, so that's where it came from. Okay. Then the sutras by Lord Buddha, they say, this is a great practice, this is an important practice, but it's not for you. Cleaning your room, straightening your room, is not so much for you, but it's a sign that you expect an important guest. Okay, it's a sign that you really believe that during your meditation, your lama's going to be there. Okay, so you don't just close your eyes and picture your lama there if you haven't made the bed. Because the lama doesn't like it when you haven't made the bed. Okay, it looks messy. What? Who got points? Aaron or Nick? Who's the wants the bed made? They were like waving at each other. Okay. So the sutras by Lord Buddha say that the reason to clean your room and make it neat and attractive is that you wouldn't invite like the Dalai Lama to your apartment if it was messy or it was, you know, junk lying around or the dishes weren't washed. So it's by tradition you go through your room and clean it and straighten it because you're expecting important guests. If you don't straighten your room, it means you don't really believe unseen holy beings are going to be there. It's a sign that you don't really know what you're doing. Okay? If your room is a mess, it's a sign that you don't know what you're doing. Okay? Because you don't really believe someone's coming. Got it? Okay. The Lam Rim gives five benefits of cleaning your room. Here you go. This is the kind of stuff I want you to put in the back, okay? You should be writing in the back. Please, I beg you. For your students' sake. Number one. They use a word that means crystal clear, Dangwa. And it also means Shraddha, like that great teacher, Sharad, right? His real name is Shraddha, faith. But the word in Tibetan is called crystal. Shraddha is translated as crystal. It means a state of mind which is crystalline and pure and devoted, Tangwa. So if your room is elegant, it could be elegant in its simplicity, right? And it could be elegant in its warmth and its messy warmth. But it should be elegant. It should be purposeful, thought out. The ambience that you want. Like, I find some temples that are too clean, too antiseptic, you know? Like, I don't feel at home there. I like a little, you know, a cat over in the corner and, you know, a monkey running around. You know, it's kind of a nice temple. And, but it should be purposely, it should be elegant, because that makes your mind clear. If the room is beautiful and elegant in your own style, then when you come into that room, you should feel happy. It should feel happy. You should, you know that, like Rob Russinger's living room. I don't know how you feel about your living room, but when I go in there, there's this light pouring in. He feeds all the, well, we're not supposed to talk about that. He has water out nowadays for the birds. There are birds singing. The sunlight's pouring in. The place is neat and beautiful. Probably Donna forces him to do that. I don't know. But even the instant coffee is put away. And it just feels good there. The place feels good. And you walk in and you're like, this feels good here. And that's the first benefit of cleaning your room. For you, it feels good. Second one, when other people walk in that room, they feel inspired and they don't really know why. You know, a real yogi's room, there's a meditation mat, well rolled up, you know, what do you call it? Leaning in the corner. But they can tell it was used this morning. You know what I mean? There's some vibe about the place. The meditation cushion doesn't have a half inch of dust on it. You know, it feels, you can feel the vibe in a spiritual person's room. You know, the yoga mat, the meditation cushion, the water bowls are worn and used, nicely worn, like an old pair of shoes, nice pair of shoes. And the meditation area feels well used in a sweet way. Okay, so the second benefit is that people who visit you can smell your practice, your sadhana, right? They can feel it. And that's the second benefit. Okay, third benefit, the beings that you cannot see, but you call bodhisattvas or Buddhas or angels, whatever you want to call them, they don't like messy places and they don't go there. They will not enter a room which is dirty. You know, they're not offended, they're repulsed by it. They don't like those places. Devas, Hlas, Yamantaka, Vajrayogini, people like that. And the lamas I believe to have been Vajrayogini, I can attest that they don't like dirty rooms. Now they just come in and they start cleaning up and then you feel so bad. You invite this lama and they start cleaning up. And then And then, you know, and then the next time you vacuum and you clean and, you know, they really do prefer, I believe, in my own life, in my own limited interaction with those kinds of beings, is that they really do prefer a sweet space, okay? And they're more willing to visit if the place is sweet, okay? That's all. Number four. If you take the trouble to make your room something which is pleasantly attractive, and I'm not talking, what do you call, glittery or gaudy. I'm not talking about that. There's some places I go in Asia where they'll say, this vajra cost, you know, $50,000 and that statue. And I'm like, I don't care, you know. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying, if you've put some effort, my lama likes the garden well done. I have to work in the garden. The garden has to have flowers all the time and hundreds of flowers. Really wonderful flowers. I'll show off. I'll make a video. It's extraordinary. But they want beauty. They want to come through beauty to come to the door, you know? And the karma. So the fourth benefit is the karma of paying attention to that is that your life becomes beautiful. Okay? Your surroundings become beautiful. The people around you become beautiful. The roads, the buildings, what other people are wearing, it's all beautiful. Okay? You just have beauty around you all the time. And you become more beautiful. Okay? Which is ironic to think that this is the tradition of Wensapa. Got it? Whose face was apparently deformed. Okay? Okay. Anyway, number five. The seeds that you collect in your mind, the deep seeds that open in future lives or in future years of your life, if you pass away or if you leave this world, you will go to a world which is very, very beautiful. The world will be very beautiful. And you know places like, there's a place in China, there's a city in South China that I went to. The first time I was there, I didn't have the karma. And it just felt cold and dark and drizzly and dismal and concrete apartment buildings. And then we worked there for 3 years. And then nowadays when I go there, it's just so warm and beautiful. And suddenly I saw a huge stupa in the middle of the city, walled off. You can't get to it. If you walk towards it, you just hit a wall by any street. But from a high apartment building, you can see it. And it's this ancient stupa in the middle of the city. And I didn't have the karma when I first got there to see it. And then later I was like, God, look at that. You know, and you can't get to it. But it's there. So the place will change. If you try to practice this, the place you live will change. Because it's coming from you, right? Okay. Then I want to tell you the story. Okay, I'm repeating. The people who've been to the Lama Rim courses and didn't fall asleep have heard this story, but I'm going to tell it again because that's what I'm doing. I'm reviewing what we did for the last few years with the Georges. So the classic story to tell at this point is the story of Chuda Pantaka, which is mean in Tibetan it's called Lam Chum. Okay, Lam means what? You know now, marga, path. And Chung means little one. So this is a bodhisattva who's in the time of Lord Buddha, whose name was Lam Chung, Chuda Pantaka, a small path, trail. I call him trail. I translate it as trail. And his brother was called Mahapantaka. Okay, big path, big road. His brother was called highway. He was called trail. Okay. How did they get their names? Okay, when they were born, there was some gek, okay? Gek means like some obstacle to their life, life force. And so in those days, if the baby comes out weak or it looks like their life might be in danger, you go to a sage and you say, what can we do that the baby will be stronger? And this Hindu sage told them, take the baby give the baby to the nurse, tell the nurse to go to a crossroads where there might be a lot of saints, Hindu or Buddhist saints, walking by. And then with the baby in the nurse's arms, the nurse should honor those saints, like Hindu mendicants or Buddhist monks, sadhus or monks. They should, the nurse should honor them and show them respect, and with the child in her arms, and then the child will be healthy. So they gave the child to the nurse, and the nurse thought it over and said, it's better if I go to like a really busy street, you know, a crossroads where there are lots of people coming by. Cause then, so she walked a long way to get to a place where there'd be lots of people coming by. And there were lots of monks coming by and lots of sadhus coming by. And every time a sadhu came by or a monk, she would, with the baby in her arms, she would say, oh, well, you know, you're so wonderful, and the Dharma is so wonderful. And she would say beautiful things to them. And then they would give their benediction to the baby. And so Mahapantaka, the older brother, grew up like that. And then he became a great sage, and he became a great teacher, and all of these blessings changed his mind. And he became very healthy, strong teacher, good mind. Then his little brother was born, and he had the same thing, he had a gig. And so they took this to the child, to the sage, and the sage says the same thing, you know, tell the nurse to take the child to a crossroads and honor sadhus and monks coming by. So this was a lazy nurse, and she didn't want to walk a long way with this baby in her arms. So she just went out back to, there's this little trail, and out back, like if you lived in India or China, you know, and took him to this little place where two trails crossed, and nobody came by. Nobody was coming by. And she's just waiting so she can go home, you know. And then Lord Buddha was in Jetavani. Jetavani, I've been there. I spent the millennium sitting there. That's where Lord Buddha taught the Diamond Cutter Sutra, at the gardens of Jetavani. And in North India. And so Lord Buddha was sitting nearby in the gardens, and with his omniscience, he saw the lady standing there with nobody walking by. So he got up and went down the trail, you know, and walked by. And the nurse is like, hi, you know, he's like, hi, and he touched the baby, you know, and then he kept going, you know. So Chittapantaka grew up. This is a funny story. I'm sorry about this story, but really dumb. And he couldn't remember anything. He was just really terrible. He just was like retarded. I'm not supposed to say retarded. Challenged. Mentally disabled, challenged. Something. He was retarded. And so he was, they were like, the family wanted to get rid of him. So this is what they do even now. They took it, even in our monastery, they'll often bring handicapped children or, you know, just because they can't take care of them. And we take them. A lot of my classmates were crippled, and they were great debaters. One didn't have a hand, and he would debate like this, you know. And he became a Geshe. He's really good. So anyway, they sent him to a Hindu school, you know, like a sage. And the sage tried to teach him, you know. And he was teaching him Om Bhur Bhuva. How's it go? Swaha. How's it go? The Gayatri. Diyo Yona Pachodaya. This Gayatri mantra. Om Bhur. See, I'm also the same. Om Bhur Bhuva. Tatsavitur Varenyam. So the Hindu sage tried to teach him the Gayatri, which starts with Om Bhur Bhuva. And then when he'd say Om, and the kid would go Om, and then he'd say Bhu, and the kid would go Bhu, and then he'd say Om Bhu, and the kid would go Om. And he'd say Bhu, he'd say Bhu. And he'd say Om Bhu, and he'd say Om. You know, and he couldn't, when he got to Om, he forgot Bhu, and when he got to Bhu, he forgot Om. He couldn't remember the first two syllables. I can't remember the fourth and fifth. But he said, then finally he kicked him out. He threw him out of the ashram. He said, this kid, not possible. He will never be, I can't do anything with this kid, you know. And then they send him to his brother's monastery, you know. And they started teaching him a mantra that was to start with siddham, to be accomplished, right? And they'd say sidd, and he'd go sidd, and they'd say dham, he'd go dham, and then they'd say siddham, and he'd say sidd. And then they'd say dham, he'd say dham. And they'd say siddham, he'd say dham. And he couldn't remember the sidd when he got to the dham, and okay, like he had this problem. And then finally his brother just, they said, look, it's not going to work out, you know. You cannot be a Hindu sadhaka, and you'll never be a Buddhist monk either, you know. And they expelled him. And they said, you're hopeless, you know. And then, of course, Lord Buddha's watching all this. And he came, somebody said, try Lord Buddha, you know. Maybe Lord Buddha can make something out of you. And they sent him to Lord Buddha, you know. And Lord Buddha was like, there was a custom then. Lord Buddha had two disciples who could read minds, and they had an assignment. They would stand at the door. They would read the person's mind and say, okay, this one's, he's monk material, or he's hopeless. And all the doorkeepers said, forget it. Don't even let him in. You know, Buddha said, no, not even. I see something. You know, I see something. Because he touched him, right, on the head. And so he let him in, and he's like, you want to be a monk? You want to be one of my monks? He said, yeah. He said, okay, you're going to sweep the temple. You're going to clean the temple, you know. Can you do that? And, you know, Chudapantaka's like, yeah, I could do that. I can do that. And he's like, okay, you sweep the temple. You just sweep the temple. And he taught him a little mantra, you know, like, what was it called? Dipapang. Dilpang, Dipapang. Oh, so the mantra was Dilpang, Jimapang. Dulpang Chimapang. Dul means dirt. Pang means clean it. Chimapang means the impurities. So he said, Dulpang Chimapang. While you're sweeping, I want you to say Dulpang Chimapang. Can you remember that? Yeah, I can remember that. Dulpang Chimapang. Okay. And then he swept. And then Lord Buddha did this thing where it was cute. He would work his way up the right side of the temple, like this temple. He'd work his way up the right side of the temple, sweeping, you know. And then Lord Buddha would like snap his fingers and dirt would settle again behind him. And then he'd work his way around the left side, and then the right side would be dirty again. And then he'd have to go by the right side and do it again. And in the meantime, the Lord Buddha made the left side dirty again by magical power. So all day he had to walk around the temple, you know, dulpang timapang, dulpang timapang, you know, clean the dirt, clean the dirt, clean the dirt. And Lord Buddha made sure he didn't have a rest. And he kept sweeping and sweeping and sweeping. And then finally, he stopped one day. He just stopped in his tracks and said, Dulpang, why did Buddha tell me to clean out the dirt, you know? Oh, it's my mind. He's talking about my mind. He got it. Timabang, oh, I have to clean out the impurities in my mind. And then he started meditating because he thought Buddha wanted him to clean out his mind, you know? He thought, oh, that's why he's asking me to clean and everything. And the practice of cleaning, got him, he became an arhat. He's one of the, 16 arhats. He's in the text. He's in the Jorcha. He's in the song. His name is forever recorded there. He's one of the 16 elders. Okay. He made it. He became an arhat, by cleaning. Okay. So cleaning is a good practice. All right, cleaning is a good practice. And then Pabong Rinpoche mentions a tradition that the Dalai Lamas would clean the Potala Palace. So they would, and there was a broom that was passed down by the Dalai Lamas. And after like three or four of them, they took this broom and they encased it in gold and hung it up so everyone would know that the Dalai Lamas thought it was important to sweep. And then he tells a story about Lord Buddha himself came one day to the Jetavani, to the gardens, and it was dirty. The leaves were still there, and they didn't deadhead the roses. And then Lord Buddha went to the garden and cleaned it himself. Okay. So Lord Buddha thought it was worth his time to clean the meditation place, okay, to straighten the meditation space. By the way, there's a story about Chudapantaka that he, one day the nuns, the local nunnery, sent a nun to Lord Buddha and said, would you come and teach at the nunnery? And he said, no, but I have a student that I could send. And they're like, oh, that's nice. Who would that be? And he said, I have this guy named Chudapantaka. And they started making inquiries, you know, like, is this a good teacher? And then everyone said, yeah, yeah, he's the guy who can't remember Om when he says boo and boo when he says Om, you know, he's going to teach you guys. And the nuns got very angry, Lord Buddha would send an idiot to teach them. Like they thought, oh, he thinks we're idiots, you know, so. They did two things. It's very similar to the story of Master Shantideva, but they did two things. First of all, they advertised to everybody in the town that this monk is coming and that the teaching is open to everybody because they were hoping to embarrass him. We heard the story from Jeff at the prison. You told the story at the prison yesterday, right? About Master Shantideva. So, they made a big advertising about the teaching, you know, and they said, everybody, just if you want to know about emptiness or this guy's, he knows everything. And they were hoping to embarrass him. So they said 12,000 people came to the teaching. And again, they made a throne which was too high. This is called a teaching throne, the platform. But they made the platform like 15 feet high and they didn't put a stair up to it. They just wanted 12,000 people to see a guy standing in front of the platform, not able to get up there, like trying to climb up. And they wanted to embarrass him. And there's a couple of versions of this story, but one is that he just reached his hand up and suddenly the hand was 15 feet long. And he went, and he lowered the throne with his finger. And then he got on it and it went back up. You know, like that. That's the story. Some stories that he just appeared on the top of the throne suddenly. Nobody knew how he got up there. And then he started to teach. And he taught half a verse and 12,000 people saw emptiness directly. Okay. People ask me how many people saw emptiness. That says 12,000. Okay. So that's the story of why it's good to clean your room, okay? It's not below us to clean, okay? It's a good practice. We have like 10 more minutes, so I'll tell you a little bit about setting up an altar, which is also part of the first preliminary, okay? And I encourage you to go through the book tonight and just look at the pictures, especially. They were carefully chosen. Rebecca helped a lot, and other people helped, and because they're all going to have a message. And I want it to trigger something in your mind. When you see that picture, I want it to trigger something in your mind. So now when you see the Ken Rinpoche's picture, it's going to trigger this thought in your mind that, you know, teacher is important. The first picture in this book is a teacher. And in our tradition, that's everything. Teacher is everything. The second picture is these roses. Okay, those are from my garden. That's a picture of my own altar. And then you look at that and you think about, I need to set up an altar and I need to have nice offerings on it. I go out every morning, go pick some nice, if you have 100 flower plants, you can go out every morning and pick one and you stagger it for the seasons, right? Some are blooming now. Like the roses are over, but these narcissus came up. I don't know why for me the narcissus grow so well. But you can always have something out there to pick and offer on your altar. It's a very sweet practice, very wonderful practice. It gets you outside in the fresh air also. So when you see that picture, think of your altar. The name in Buddhism for an altar is Ku Sung Tuk Ten. Say Ku Sung Tuk Ten. Ten means... like a home base, R-T-E-N, right? Ratatatadamatena ten. It means home base or headquarters. For ku, for sung, and for tuk. Ku means enlightened being's body. Sung means their speech, and tuk means their state of mind, right? So this cardboard box on which you put a napkin, right, you're not really going to do that, but... is meant to house the actions and the words and the thoughts of a divine being. Okay? It's meant to be 1 square foot in your apartment or your house, which is where they hang out. Okay? So, you know, I have a kind of a big one. Not that big. Not this big. But that part of your house is sacred. And in that part of the house is where the holy beings hang out. It's Kusum Tukten. The name for altar in Tibetan is where they hang out. Where they speak, where they act, and where they think is that place. That's the name for an altar. And then by tradition, we put something to remind us of each of those three on the altar. Okay, that's just a tradition. And this is what, in our tradition, hang on. In our tradition, there would be 4 things on the altar, minimum 4 things on the altar, okay, in our tradition. First is some kind of image of Lord Buddha, okay, to the historical Buddha. Secondly, in our immediate tradition, you would have some kind of image of Jetsong Kapa, okay? We are very fortunate that, I don't know if the retreatants have seen, but a Chinese sponsor donated a very beautiful gilded image of Jetsong Kapa. Or you can use that red book, has hundreds of them in there. We have a nice image of Jetsong Kapa up there. But if you belong to this lineage, if you are studying in this lineage, you should have something to remind you of Jetsong Kapa on the altar, okay? Because that's where we all come from. That's where our immediate lineage comes from. So that's those two, image of Lord Buddha and an image of Jetsong Kapa. It could be a painting, could be a print, it could be a statue, it could be a satsa, it could be the book, something to remind you of Jetsong Kapa. There's several Jetsong Kapa images in here, and you could keep this on your altar also. Those two are the actions of an enlightened being. Those two statues or those two images represent the ku, the holy actions. Okay, sung, you should have some kind of scripture on the altar. Okay, for our immediate tradition, the Diamond Cutter Sutra, any sutra of the Prajnaparamita, Heart Sutra, Diamond Cutter Sutra, 8,000 verses, these are very, very powerful. Especially Diamond Cutter Sutra. Okay, that's why we named it Diamond Cutter Institute. That's why this is called Diamond Mountain. We were talking about changing the name because we got so much bad press. And I don't know, we're all kind of like, we're proud of the name, you know. Let's just let them adjust. You know, so some kind of Diamond Cutter. Okay, something to do with Diamond Cutter. If it's on your altar, that's a tradition in our immediate lineage. Okay. Then a bell and Dorje, especially if you've had a tantric initiation. Bell and thunderbolt, those represent the mind, okay? The scripture represents the speech of a Buddha, and the bell and Dorje represent the mental state of an enlightened being. The Dorje represents love, and the bell represents wisdom, okay? All right. And I'll tell you something interesting. In Tibet, it's a tradition. When you go to someone's house, you say, "Can I see your altar?" But they don't use the word "see." They use the word "jel." Okay, Mao Jala Jel, and "jel" means to be in the presence of a holy being. You see, or to meet somebody. So in Tibet, the word for seeing someone's altar, when you go to someone's home, you say, "Can I gel your altar? Can I meet the beings on your altar?" You see, you don't say, "Can I see a tanka in your house?" You don't use the word "see" for tankas or for statues. It's a very beautiful custom. They say, can I make the acquaintance of the holy beings on your altar? It means, can I come and look at your altar? And it's a big deal in Tibet. And Rinpoche used to hit me, you know, I'd be like, "Wow, that's cool," you know, and he'd say, "Get those hands up there, you know, no, thumbs inside, you know, like, bow down, put your head on the altar," and, you know, there's a way to gel a Kusum Tukten, you know, and you're supposed to feel the being who's there. And it's not like, oh, hey, you got a cool image of Jetson Kapoor, you know? You're supposed to think you're in the presence of that being. You know, when you see someone's altar, you meet the altar. The altar is a very sacred thing in Tibet. And everyone has one. And a lot of families dedicate a whole room to their kusum tukten, you know. But at least you should have one in your bedroom or something. Okay. And you shouldn't have your feet towards it. That's a tradition also. Okay, we got like 2 minutes left, and it's working out perfectly. There's a story. You know Shariputra, right? Shariputra. This is one of the monks who was in the... He recites the Heart Sutra. He's the one who speaks the Heart Sutra, right? Shariputra. Very, 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 very famous disciple of Lord Buddha. And then they say, how did he meet Lord Buddha? What was his karma that he could be Lord Buddha's big disciple in this lifetime? You know, what happened in his previous life? And there's stories about it. And it's a cool story. He was hiking somewhere. He was on a trip walking through Tibet. And his shoe fell apart, which is very common in Tibet. Because they, you know, they just sewed them up. And his shoe fell apart. Sorry, not Tibet, India, but Northern India. And he was walking and previous lifetime. Anyway, shoes fall apart. And he was walking and his shoe fell apart. And then he realized he'd have to stop and sew it, and he couldn't go anywhere that night. He'd have to stop and seek shelter. So he looked around and all he could find was an old temple, like a broken down temple. This is very common in Asia. Like if you take a bus trip, Lady Ruth knows, to Mysore to Bangalore or something, in the rice fields, you'll see lots of old abandoned temples. And they kind of leave them there, and it's kind of really beautiful. So he saw an abandoned temple, you know, and he crawled into one corner of it that wasn't wet. And he's like fixing his shoe, you know. And then he started a fire because it was cold. And then he looked up on the wall, and in the flickering light of the fire, he saw an image of a Buddha, an old mural on the wall. And he's like a fresco. And he's like, and he just, something happened to him, and he stopped sewing, and he was sitting there, and in the firelight, he's staring at this Buddha image. He says, oh, that's the most beautiful thing I ever saw in my life, you know. And then he says, I'd give anything to be a disciple of somebody like that. And that was it. And the next morning he got up, he forgot all about it, and he just walked away. But that was the karma, the admiration. They say not so much the admiration of the artwork or something, but the feeling that he might have been in the presence of a divine being in that moment is what made him be born as Shariputra. So that's in a section of the Lamrim where they say, try to reach a point. And this happens when you see emptiness directly, most strongly. It happens to some extent before that. But especially if you've seen emptiness directly, something happens to your appreciation of paintings and statues. If you reach that point in your spiritual journey, then when you see a statue, it comes alive. And you see the being in it. You see who it was, you know? And then you have this very strange but very standard reaction that you get down on you do a Surya Namaskar. That's what those things are, really. You get down on your stomach, not just down on your knees. You get down and you put your head down and you put your body down and you prone on the ground. That's where that custom came of Namaskara, of prostration. It came from people who saw real divine beings and had to get down on their bellies and put their face in the ground, okay? And it only happens to special people. Like someday it will happen to you. And you'll meet somebody and see who they are. And you get down on and you put your face in the ground. I always read this thing about Moses met the burning bush or something, and his reaction is to throw himself on the ground. If you ever see a Buddha or a divine being, you cannot help yourself. This, you will do the same thing automatically. You cannot stop yourself. Everyone who ever sees a divine being throws himself on the ground and puts their face in the dirt. And there's this whole custom of prostration and bowing down to lamas and all that. That came from that. Okay. So it'd be nice to do the real one someday. It'd be nice to have a real one happen. Okay. And they say that, why are we talking about that? Putting nice images on your altar, careful thought about an image, taking good care of it, honoring it as if it were that being, then one day it will happen to you. You will meet them. Okay. So take care of the, lots of people have lots of, they just treat their altar like a junk collection place. They put little knickknacks. It's a knickknack collection, kusum knickknack ten. And, don't do that, okay? You know what they do in the monastery, which is a very good custom, and then we'll stop. It's 9:30. They rotate the images. And they actually have another room that has basketball lockers all the way up to the ceiling. It's like 40 feet high. To get up to the locker, you have to climb on a special ladder and kill yourself. And they have hundreds of sacred images. And the kunyer, the temple keeper, his job is to change them every 2 or 3 days. So a tanka only stays up in the Sera temple for 2 or 3 days, and then it gets replaced by some other image. And then that helps you appreciate it. If you leave an image on your altar for months or years, I got this thing in my eye, it's called floaters. I was all worried. I went to the optometrist. And I said, I see these black things floating across my eye, you know, and then sometimes they go like this. He says, yeah, those are floaters. And I'm like, well, I heard if you do headstand, you get bad floaters. He said, nah, that's BS. And then I said, well, what do I do about it? He said, don't worry. You just leave them there. They're inside your eyes, some kind of crystals inside your eye, and they suck in light and they look black. And they float around in your eye. And then I said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, your mind cancels them after like 2 months. Your mind cancels them out of the picture. And you don't see them anymore. They're there. They're still there. And they're in the same place. But your mind decides to ignore them. A lot of old tankas are like that. Like you get used to them. You have one of the most beautiful images, Gandharvan images of a Buddha here. You have an extraordinary images here in this temple. In this temple you have extraordinary images. They're very valuable actually. And the Shiva and everything are very extraordinary images, but they're like, you just got used to them. You don't even see them anymore. So it's good to change them sometimes, because then you can honor them and appreciate them. Okay, so it's a good to rotate rather than keeping all the images you have on the altar. Then it looks like a knick-knack collection facility. Like rotate them, and then you appreciate them more. And then try to get this emotion. And they say, regardless of the quality of the artist. Right? Regardless of the skill of the artist, appreciate them as a divine being. Somebody saw a divine being, painted it. Somebody else copied it. Somebody else copied that. Somebody else copied that. Somebody else copied that. But if you trace it back, someone saw a divine being and painted it, you know? And so think about that. Every image you see here of like Tara or Jetson Kapa or these divine beings, they come from many generations, but the first generation was painted from the real thing. Somebody saw them. Okay? So just think about that and don't treat them lightly. Okay? And then you'll have this experience of running into them. And then you'll find out what a real prostration is. And all the Surya Namaskars are just practicing for that. Okay? All right, Dr. Phil. Shall we? That's the first Georgia. Clean your room, put up an altar. Okay. Sang ye shing
Sahana meshe,